Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to Your Health Today at the University of Maryland Medical Center. We're returning today to the Neonatal Intensive Care Unit. We're about to meet Dr. Adora Wanodi.
What sets this NICU apart from what happens in other places? I mean, I understand this is a pretty specialized and unique unit.
Yes. Our NICU is what's called a level 3C.
Which means
that we care for a range of babies who have different problems. And the reason why we are able to do that is because we offer a lot of different services and therapies. By services, I mean we have the advantage of having other doctors or other subspecialists besides the neonatologists to help us take care of these babies when they have or develop specific problems. We also have a number of therapies which we're able to offer, like if one of the babies here has, let's say, a problem with kidney function, then we have a pediatric nephrologist here. If one of the babies develops a surgical problem, then we have pediatric surgeons who would help us manage those problems. We also have a number of therapies which we're able to offer, and such therapies are different types of mechanical ventilation and whole body cooling, which is a relatively new therapy out there that we use for babies who have suffered from birth asphyxia.
After we spoke with Dr. Adora Wanodi, we went across the hall to meet the Greens. Their daughter Ellie was born prematurely and has been in the NICU for over 2 months.
This is the Green family, baby Ellie.
So tell us a bit about your story.
Well, I say our story started before we ever were at university, and ultrasounds revealed there was problems, different things going on. Ultimately, we wound up in the CAFCA with Dr. Harmon down there, and he recommended that we continue our process here. And on February 7th was when she was born.
She was born at 32 weeks. So she was 3 pounds, 6 ounces when she was born. So a little bit earlier than we expected.
during the blizzard. So it was 50 inches of snow outside. And
it must have been frightening.
It was very nerve-wracking, yes. But we ended up getting here safely before anything major happens.
They tried to stop the labor. When we came in, they did everything possible to be able to send us back home. And there's just no stopping it. So we got to have that process early.
Your baby's been in the hospital since the storm?
Yes, she's been in here for 9 weeks. She's had a couple surgeries with Dr. Voigt, and she's been on dialysis since she was about a week old. They started dialysis for her kidneys because her kidneys aren't functioning. So she will be getting a kidney transplant as well. A lot of scary moments throughout that time frame, but she's doing great now. We're talking about maybe getting her home within a couple weeks.
So when you take her home in a couple of weeks, you'll be coming back and forth here a lot, obviously, for a while to come.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when we go home, she's actually going to be on dialysis at home, and she'll be going to weekly visits with her nephrologist and coming back here for NICU follow-up visits, and she'll have a lot of appointments. But so we'll be in and out of the hospital a lot, but only for a short while. So they're saying maybe she'll get her kidney transplant around 18 months. So after that, she'll be perfectly healthy. But the care here has been great, and we can't say enough how grateful we are for all the doctors and all the nurses. And even when I was in the hospital over in labor delivery, they were all really great over there, and we couldn't ask for a more caring group of staff. So it's made things a lot easier than it could have been.
Well, thank you again so much, and good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For more information about the Neonatal Intensive Care Unit at the University of Maryland Hospital for Children, you can go to umm.edu/pediatrics or just call 1-800-492-5538. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner.
I'm Anthony McCarthy.
Before we begin, Anthony, I want to make this announcement here that support for WEAA is provided by Maryland Public Television, presenting the MPT Green Raffle bonus drawing on May the 27th for an 8-day trip to Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks. The grand prize is a custom solar home plus a hybrid Honda Insight. Tickets at MPT's greenhomeraffle.com. You can go to http://www.mptgreenhomeraffle.com.
That's a lot.
To say?
That's a lot to say. That sounds exciting. Great,
it does.
Great prize.
I think we might be going there this summer.
All right, brother.
No, not with them. I mean.
I understand.
All right. So Anthony McCarthy and I are here with you. Of course, Anthony's show is on the air at this time every Friday from 5 to 7 p.m. Also a fellow production of the Center for Emerging Media, where Anthony McCarthy is a senior media fellow. And then, of course, he's a advisor to more people than I have hands and toes.
Surprisingly, a lot of people want to listen these days. You notice I said these days.
They should have listened before. And the number here is 410-319-8888. We're going to begin by talking with Kate Shepard, who covers energy and environmental politics for the Washington Bureau of Mother Jones Magazine. And you can go to our website and link on to her blog at Mother Jones. She's been writing some really interesting things about what's been going on in the Gulf and a lot of questions we all have. Join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Kate Shepard, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us, Kate. I was reading your blog earlier today. Fascinating stuff. Great, great stuff.
Never-ending sources of information.
So tell us, this really hit me last week with some articles I was reading at the end of the week about many of the oceanographers and the ocean scientists were really jumping on the Obama White House and NONAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, for not forcing BP to allow the federal government to see all the data that they were pulling from the ocean about what's going on, what's been happening with this oil spill. Could you tell us about that? I was really shocked to read that.
That they weren't being more forceful about it, or?
That they weren't being, well, I can understand corporations not being forthcoming, but I was surprised that our government wasn't being more forceful in demanding this information.
Well, you'd think at this point that they would be. They've also been really slow on even giving BP much direction down there on, you know, what chemicals they're pouring in the Gulf. They're still not giving, you know, any kind of direction on, you know, how they really think this should be stopped. It's all within BP's ballpark still. I mean, the federal government, I think, has tried to be as hands-off about this as possible. They want to make this BP's problem, not theirs, and I think they're worried that if they get too much more involved, it'll look more like their problem.
Well, maybe I'm a little confused by that. I mean, you think this is a time that the federal government, given how much flack and how the attacks were just omnipresent with President Bush on his lack of response to Hurricane Katrina, that after we experienced the Valdez and other spills we've had, that there are spills actually that have been bigger than this around the world in between that the government wouldn't step in to force BP to give more information and have kind of a more of a take charge attitude when it comes to the spill. What do you think is going on?
Well, I think there's two things. I think they, for the first few weeks, really underestimated the extent of the spill. I think that was clear. You know, it wasn't until the end of April, early March, that people really started getting concerned and realizing how big this was. So the administration was a little bit slow on that front. And I think they really have trusted BP to know how to handle this. I mean, they trust them to know how to stop the well. They've trusted them to know how to clean this up. I mean, I think it really highlights the inadequacy of our national response plan. We rely on oil companies to have these responses in place, and the government is just not equipped to. And I mean, I think it really raises questions about whether we should really be allowing offshore drilling in these locations if we don't have an adequate response plan, and we only trust companies to tell us that they could handle it, and then to actually handle it if something happens.
Kate, I want to ask you about Interior Secretary Salazar, and he's really taking some heat for exactly what you just said about direction, and that BP is being left on their own devices, and they seem to really be growing more and more frustrated by their attempts time after time to cap this well, to stop the oil flow. And they fail. And it really highlights this idea that we're not requiring people to have these plans and contingencies in place. And I've been reading a lot about what the secretary is kind of getting more and more frustrated, taking the heat for this. But I guess I'm trying to figure out how we can hold both the government responsible, but also hold these companies responsible for, you know, the messes that they make.
Well, this is the real issue here. I mean, both are responsible. We look back at when BP was first proposing to drill this rig in the Gulf. These companies are required to put together a plan that says, yes, we have these responses in place, and here's what we would do in the event of a disaster. But, you know, we look at these plans, and most of the time these companies are saying, oh, we don't think that a spill is possible. And if it is possible, we have all the plans lined up. We have the equipment ready. We have the people who could fix a spill like this. And clearly the government actually hasn't done the job of going through and making sure that's true. We've just basically rubber stamped these oil companies in going into areas that are not safe, that are not easy to drill, where we haven't actually verified that they have the response capabilities in place. So it's both the fault of the government and the fault of the companies. The companies for basically lying and saying that they could handle something like this, and the government for not actually making sure they could.
And we are, Mark, continuing to approve permits for drilling, even as we are waiting for miles and miles of cleanup to take place, but we got to stop the oil flow. I learned that on Kate's website also.
And environmental waivers we've allowed. And that was it 19 environmental waivers for Gulf drilling have taken place since the April 20th explosion. Now, have you questioned people in the government about what's going on and why this is happening?
Well, Salazar had to speak about this at one of the Senate panels last week. People asked him about this, and he said, well, you know, this isn't new drilling. We definitely stopped new drilling. But, you know, he said also made it very clear that, you know, we've allowed the current drilling operations to continue. And Carol Browner, the White House advisor on energy and climate, was asked this in this afternoon's press conference as well. And she said, well, these aren't permits for new drilling. They're not permits for new holes in the ground. They're for things that are already out there. They're already operating in the Gulf and on shore. But I mean, that should be a cause of concern as well, as we see that this was a rig that exploded and spilled that had all these permits in place and, you know, didn't have the proper environmental analysis, no one knew that this was going to happen. So clearly there should be some more analysis of these waivers that we've given out and these permits that we've given out that maybe weren't justified.
Well, we have Kate Shepard on the line here. You can join us here at 410-319-8888. I'm just curious about what people think about the White House and President Barack Obama and his response to all of this. I mean, one of the things that seems to be people have been arguing this is a prime opportunity for positions to be taken about the future of energy in America. I mean, even at its best, if America was to be able to transition from oil and gas, from fossil fuels to quote-unquote cleaner energy, it would be about 20-30 years before we could really make that transition. But it seems to me nobody at the moment, Katie, is even making the argument about how to take what we have now and fill that 30% gap, which is and move to a cleaner energy and away from drilling in this country. But I don't hear those kind of discussions taking place.
No, I think number one, the administration has capitalized on this spill in a way that would help move us forward. They keep saying that we need to continue with offshore drilling, and this is important. But I mean, the amount of oil that we're getting from these operations is clearly not worth the kind of disaster we're seeing right now. And if we were to really do some serious efficiency, to really ramp up our fuel economy standards for cars and trucks, and, you know, the administration's made advances on those fronts, but we could do more. Those would have much more of an impact on our consumption of foreign fuels than our drilling in the Gulf of Mexico is having right now.
Kate, I want to ask you, in your writing, your research, how are the other states? I know Louisiana, the governor talks every day about the help that the state is needing to offset what's going to happen in the long term with this spill. But Mississippi and Florida, we're starting to hear a lot about how not only are their economies for tourism being impacted, but obviously the environmental impact of those very sensitive areas in Mississippi and in Florida. How are they anticipating they're going to be impacted by this ongoing flow of oil?
I think you're right. Bobby Jindal in Louisiana has been much more vocal about this because he already has oil washing up on
the
state's coastline. You know, we've seen all these horrible pictures of oil.
Pelicans.
Pelicans coated in oil, you know, marshes and wetlands coated in oil. So we're already seeing it there. You know, it's not it's not as obvious yet in these other states, and I think we'll see much more concern as it does does start washing up there. And Jindal's has been out in front of this. His state was obviously the most directly impacted, and they have a very keen awareness of disasters in their state there,
yeah.
So they are primed to respond to this kind of thing. And I think we'll hear more from the other states as time goes by. I mean, Crist has been out front saying, this is why we don't think we should have offshore drilling. He's gone back and forth on this issue for years, but now has been, decidedly anti-expansion of drilling due to the spill. And, he has, I think he's been a little occupied with the Senate race, but I'm sure we'll see him a little bit more involved as well.
The one last thing, one of the things I think that in terms of the response of the senators and congressmen who are against offshore drilling from people in the environmental community, unless I'm missing it, Kate Shepard, what I've not seen a great deal of are people making the argument about what we do instead, about how we make the transition from fossil fuels to other energy. Now, that's, I think, part of the problem. I mean, American people are very nervous about this. Because you're not going to get them out of their cars. It's going to take a long time for any transition to take place. And if that's in fact true, then people in the environmental community, it seems to me, should be activists, should be, along with their representative in Congress who backed this, should be kind of voicing a plan about how America becomes free of this. And I've not heard much talk about that other than them being angry at President Obama and angry at BP Oil.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, people really could be doing a lot more to amplify that message of what they should be doing instead. I think environmental advocates are trying to get their voices out there. They're trying to talk about the alternatives, talk about fuel efficiency, talk about moving to hybrid vehicles, moving to electric vehicles. I think they're talking about these alternatives to oil consumption, but maybe it's not loud enough, and maybe it's not being heard in the right places. But I think that there really needs to be much more of this discussion from congressional leaders, from the White House. I mean, it's a huge policy change that needs to be undertaken here if we're going to transition away from oil. And I think there's been some hesitancy to really embrace that. It all goes back to the fact that, we have an oil industry that's very close to a lot of people in government here. There's a hesitancy, I think, by a lot to be really critical of the oil industry and maybe a little bit hesitant to use this disaster as an opportunity. And I think it really should. If we look back at history, the only time we've ever gotten major environmental reforms passed was when we had some kind of disaster after Exxon Valdez, after
right.
Santa Barbara oil spill in '69. These are things that previously have inspired generations to make really radical changes.
Kate Shepard, it's been a pleasure to have you with us, and we will probably take up this challenge and see if we can't get people on here to renew this debate about where we really should go from here and how we get there. And we will link to your writing on our website, and thanks so much for all the probing and pushing you do online and in Mother Jones.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Kate.
Take care.
Take care.
When Anthony McCarthy and I return, we are going to take a look at Rand Paul.
The Republican candidate for the United States Senate in Kentucky.
Kentucky and race and tea parties and what are we actually watching here and why and what do these people represent. And so stay with us for all that. As we go to that break and come back, we'll be joined by, looks like James Rucker will be here, from A Color Change, which is great, and Susan Jacobson Gaztanaga from the Libertarian Party. Number is 410-319-8888. As we get there, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Marlene and Stuart Greenebaum Cancer Center, an NCI-designated cancer center providing research, treatment, and education to further the prevention of and cure of cancer. Online at www.umgcc.org. Well, the number for information is 1-800-888-8823. We'll be right back.